Have you ever looked at those nutrition labels in the grocery store and thought, surely this is a well-reasoned and scientific process? Well, I got some news for you, and there's only one undertaker from the 18th century who can give us all the answers. This week on Seemingly Unrelated. Welcome back to Seemingly Unrelated. This is the podcast that dives way deep into the stories behind everyday life so we can better understand our history, we understand our society and our culture. This guy right here, I'm Dr. Andrew Johnstone from the University of Glasgow, and I'm joined, as always, by the amazing producer, the wunderkind, Naomi. How are you doing this episode, Naomi?
Hello! I don't actually know what a wunderkind is.
Means person who is good at things.
Oh, I like it then. Thank you very much, Andrew.
This episode, we've got another special guest. And I would say an extra special guest, because this guest is, unlike all those trash bag guests before, I'm kidding, an actual science communicator. That is a thing that she has a degree in. And in fact, a former dolphin trainer, if I'm not mistaken. Wow. It is Amy Weldon. Amy, how are you doing?
Whee! I'm doing great. I'm still kind of wrapping my brain around the fact that I'm drinking my coffee. It's 9:30 a.m. here, and you all are getting cozy because it's, you know, 5:30, right?
PM. I've already been to a whole market.
Yeah. You know? I went to the gym. You know, the sun is starting to set. Yeah, it's great. Time is
amazing. Stupid. But I'm good. I'm really happy to be here. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited as well. Amy, I gave a little sample there of your bio, but would you mind introducing yourselves to the listeners who don't know you as well as I do, and the reasons why they might be excited to be here, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So like Andrew said, I am Amy Weldon. I am a professional science communicator, which means that I do everything from science writing to writing the scripts for YouTube videos. When you see the talking head scientist with, you know, the space backdrop on a video, I'm the person sitting behind the camera that they're actually talking to when they're answering the questions about physics or material science or whatever. And I also have done, you know, web copy and blogging and social media quite a bit. So it's the coolest thing ever. I'm super lucky to get to do this, especially right now when science is so needed. I also moonlight as a podcaster myself. And so we'll talk a little bit about my show, but it's kind of perfect because, as you mentioned, I was a dolphin trainer and now I am a science communicator with a desk job. And so those two things are seemingly unrelated, right?
It's true. You learned everything you need to know about science communication from the great communicators, dolphins.
Obviously. It's true. It's true. Although I try to deliver my communications with less sass than they do.
So, Amy, I got a simple question to get things started. You're at the grocery store. You're buying yourself a pack of whatever. Let's say you're buying yourself a box of cereal. Do you trust the nutrition label on the back of those food products?
Oh, man. So many food-related triggers with nutrition labels. The answer would be, depends on the company the label creaky belongs hands. To, maybe. Yeah,
creaky depends hands. On the company, which is a funny thing, right? The nutrition label itself has nothing to do with companies. They do not choose what content goes onto that nutrition label. Nutrition labels are in the European Union and all of the North American countries, and also the United Kingdom, which I now have to say is not part of the European Union, but all of them mandate what goes on that nutrition label. When do we think the first mandating of food labels went into effect?
I feel like it was like the 60s, perhaps mm-hmm. the 70s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a good guess. But no, the mandate and the invention, this is shocking, the mandate and the invention came at the same time, of the nutrition label actually dated to 1990. So there are really very, very, very few, scant dozens of examples of anyone labeling nutrition on packaging of food before 1994, since 1994 in the U.S. Hazard a guess, Amy. When does it become the law in the European Union? It's after 1994. That's my hint.
I want to say it was very recently. I want to say it was in years that start with a 2.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. I'm just going to pull a number completely out of time and space and say 2005. I don't know.
Not far off. No, 2011, the European Union passed the Food Information for Consumers Law. And since the UK was part of the European Union at that time, that is also when the United Kingdom got nutrition labels. So the weird thing is that both you and I, Amy, are older than nutrition labels. And Naomi, this is weird, you're older than nutrition labels being in the United Kingdom. That's a thing that appeared in your lifetime.
I think I do actually remember it a bit, though.
Yeah?
Because I remember it being like a thing the European Union were asking us to do. And then I remember when we were like leaving the European Union, crying face, we were like, I was like, are they going to get rid of that stuff that they implemented with like the labels? I don't know. That was something that stuck in my head, because I think at the time, I remember when it was part of the news, I was like, the European Union be doing stuff to help us know about nutrition.
No. Instead, the UK decided to add also a label to the front of food products, which is just color coded. And it turns out nobody cares about it. It is the ignored thing ever. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing.
So two things. One, I feel much like Naomi. I feel like that was about the time as a young adult I was starting to pay attention to news and things that didn't directly affect me. Yeah. But then the second thing, because again, nerd, curious. So the 90s, that was also about when Surgeon General warnings were being put on cigarette packaging as well. Like they were label happy then. That makes sense. Okay. Huh.
And we are going to kind of hint as to why that is by the end of this episode, because it certainly will make a little bit of sense. All right. The things that are mandated, what has to be on a nutrition label. This is true in both the United Kingdom and the United States. It has slightly changed in the EU and Canada, but we don't care about them. So let's talk about what goes on UK nutrition labels. All right. Number one, kilojoules and kilocalories, how much energy is in your food. Mass of fat in grams, everything will be in grams. Saturates, which is saturated fats. Carbohydrates, sugars, protein, salt or sodium. They can include, but it is not always required, fiber. And additional listings such as vitamins and minerals are only required, both in the UK and in the US, if the food product makes some sort of health claim. So, for example, a box of cereal always has all of the nutrients, all of the vitamins and minerals, because cereals are fortified, and that's part of their marketing, that they're, quote, part of a complete breakfast. That's the thing because they say that, they must show you all of the vitamins and minerals.
And now for something completely unrelated. Is that an English thing that we like make cereals healthy though? Because I remember like I've seen a YouTubers from like America looking at our cereals and being like, they're all so boring. None of them are multicolored and they're not sweet. Like,
there's no caffeine-coated sugar bombs. How am I supposed to get along here?
In England, it's kind of like, you're going to eat your wheat, and it will be dry and flavorless.
It's a funny thing, Naomi. And Amy, back knowing this, because you've lived in both countries, the difference between a grocery store in the United States and a grocery store in the United Kingdom. Take the cereal aisle of Britain, okay? That's going to be shelf one of 12.
Think of the big Tesco and then like add another couple of meters to the end of the longest aisle and then cover that from top shelf to bottom shelf in rainbow cartoon character covered packaging, every kind of cereal you could possibly.
Is there enough people eating and buying this cereal? This is the confusion for me.
No, that's actually a microcosm of the American food scenario at large. It's like, is there enough people to eat all this food? And the answer is No. Or we're not getting it. We're not getting it to them. That's the real question. Yes. We're not getting it to them.
It's always important to remember that the United States every year produces enough food to ensure that every single human being alive has 2,125, I think, calories per day and a complete protein and vitamin and mineral profile.
That's insane.
Yes. The United States has a lot of waste.
Oh, well, that took a depressing turn from cereal.
USA. USA. So what the hell did we do before nutrition labels, right? Because that seems bizarre to think that it's only been around for such a short amount of time. What did people do for all that time before? Because packaged food is a thing that's been around since the late 18th century. So like what? The good news is we didn't do anything for the first 100 years, but from 1898 forward, the USDA instituted the first fair advertising laws, which basically said, like, you couldn't make claims about your food being, like, healthy or anything like that. So it was just sort of to distinguish healthy versus unhealthy food. Because in the 1880s and 90s, we had a rash of just people being like, drink this tonic. It'll give you superpowers. And the USDA was like, no, stop it.
That's cocaine.
You're just feeding people cocaine and arsenic in equal measure.
I'm just imagining this somebody at the USDA with like a square bottle. No, put that down. No, stop it. You can't do that.
Stop it. Bad dog.
Sounds like that would really give you a kick up the ass, though. It'd be lovely.
We also had for several decades, the USDA and Health and Human Services would put together different campaigns over what was called a basic diet. And they would mention and recommend various combinations of vegetable matter, meat, fruit, dairy, and grains that would ensure that the average American met their essential minimum requirements. So you're probably most familiar with the food pyramid, right, which we're not going to get into today because that story is nuts. But there were a bunch of different things other than just the food pyramid that were trying to get people to hit their minimums. And then we move to this, never mind, we're going to put a nutrition label that's going to give you, like, down to the gram, literally, what's inside of the food you're eating. So how could this shift have possibly happened? What happened? And I think, Amy, you're someone who lifts weights and probably therefore has certain dietary elements you must account for in order to make that weightlifting more or less effective. Do you take any supplements on a regular basis?
What are we qualifying as a supplement today?
That's a good question. What do you think of when I say supplement?
I think most people would say protein. Sure. And I know collagen is a big one right now. I think the Athletic Greens, I know that's a company over here that's like basically powdering all of the nutrition you get from dark, beautiful veggies, chicory, you know, arugula. Yeah. So I think those would be what I would qualify. Instead of eating delicious greens, right? Sorry, guilty. Put it in a smoothie. Thank you so much. I think those what I would qualify as like most people's supplements in general. Yeah.
My mum hates vitamin supplements. Mm-hmm. Okay. To the point where, so when I was younger, I had a cold, and I had this gig coming up and I had to sing and I was really scared about not being able to sing. So I bought the effervescence, like Barocca style vitamin C things. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Pretty harmless, pretty day to day to take that. And I started drinking them and I used to hide them in my room because I was scared that my mum would find them. Because she's a nurse. And
I just like the idea that like in a normal person's house, it would be hiding like drugs and you're like, I don't want my parents to find out the weed. But you're like, I had to hide from my mom, who's a nurse, my vitamin C supplements.
Yes.
Contraband.
She found them and she threw them away.
Jan, no.
I was so annoyed. And do you know what? She did actually say that she felt a bit bad about it when I came to her. I was like, I've got a cold. And she was like, just so bad for you. Reason is, her theory, and I think this has been proven, is if you have enough vitamins in your diet, yeah, your body self-regulates your vitamins. So if you have too many of one vitamin, it'll pee out. If you have not enough of it, it will reserve some of the vitamins that you had in other stuff. So she's saying that these supplements give you so many vitamins, they give you a whole daily allowance of vitamin, yes, C, but you're getting vitamin C from like eating in your diet anyway. And so then your body has this big spike of vitamin C, then your liver and kidneys have to work overtime to filter out all the vitamin C, and then you just pee all of it out and your liver and kidney have worked really hard. So there you go.
Yeah.
It's not the worst theory that anyone's come up with. It is not in the research I did for this episode, because this is part of what the research in this episode is. There is no data to suggest that a daily multivitamin, basically, that it has any kind of long-term health problems, mm-hmm, associated with it. It also doesn't have any long-term health benefits associated with,
yeah,
it. It's, mm-hmm, it does it make it is the sort of thing. It is the sort of thing. What are you eating? Are you actually eating a balanced diet? If the answer is no, as Amy pointed out, a supplement could cover some missing pieces. We in Scotland, for example, need this is recommended by the NHS to take a vitamin D supplement in,
oh yeah,
the winters.
That's the one thing my parents take is vitamin D, because they're like, yeah, we don't get enough of that.
Yeah,
so I guess that's the line, is if you're already getting enough in your diet, you don't need to then take a multivitamin.
Correct.
That has all the vitamins in.
Yes. So vitamins are where we must take our story. So the vitamins, oddly enough, people had an idea of something in food that was not just food, that was really helpful for preventing disease. And then in 1910, two gentlemen, Casimir Funk and Elmer McCollum, Funk and McCollum, both within like a couple months of each other discovered vitamins. Like they found the thing, right? Funk isolated vitamin C and McCollum vitamin B12, and they were amines. And so it is vitamine, which means basically life protein sort of thing, or like life essence would be the way to think of it. So that's all it means. It's just, that's why they're called vitamins. Fun fact.
Cool.
So
yeah,
these guys were trying to study disease. They were trying to prevent disease. It had been known that certain foods could prevent certain diseases since the 17 teens, when British ships were taking lemons to stop scurvy, right? So it's Funk who pursues vitamin C. He wants to stop scurvy. And it is McCollum who's obsessed with a disease called beriberi. And that's why he discovers vitamin B12, also known as thiamine. So they realize that the thing that's in the food that keeps people from getting those diseases is these amines, these vitamins. And so they both recommend that people eat more foods that have those vitamins in them. This is the start of people thinking, interesting, maybe we can take food and break it down into its like constituent parts and understand what nutrition is. Basically, McCollum and Funk invented nutrition science. Now listen, nutrition scientists out there have done the history of nutrition science. I know you, there are like 24 other people I haven't cited. This is an hour-long podcast, and we're recording at minute 34. I don't know what the final cut's going to look like, but listen to me. I got to get to it. McCollum and Funk invented nutritional science.
All the indigenous people are like, yeah, cool, yeah, sure, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Who could have known that eating the whole plant would be good for you? I don't know. Surely these two white guys.
Now, that's the thing. People knew what plants eat. These are the guys who are identifying the proteins and the amino acids and the constituent parts. They're quantifying nutrition is the way to think of it. Fast forward to 1941, so 31 years later, the National Nutrition Conference for Defense formed in the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they came up with clear guidance on how much of certain foods people needed to eat to be physically fit enough to pass a military health exam and therefore fight Nazis.
Wow. I thought you were just going to say for the troops to make sure like our troops were fueled. No. But like even for, wow. Okay.
We had a real problem though. Both world wars, the United States had a real problem, which was that there weren't enough people. There weren't enough men, should specify, who could pass the physical fitness test. Like they were just too skinny and they were too malnourished. And so starting in 1941, it's like, all right, we need to explain to people what they have to eat so that we can actually have an army big enough to fight Hitler. Bingo cards punched. World War II has appeared.
Thank God. I was getting worried we wouldn't talk about it.
Exactly. It's been too long. So
it's been one whole episode since we last mentioned it.
Naomi was going to go home and be like, dear diary, today on the episode, it didn't happen. I don't know.
I don't know if Andrew's not feeling okay.
My North Star is lost. By the end of the 1940s, if you are in a high-income country, there's some kind of guidelines in place at the governmental level, at the national level, for what is considered healthy food, right? After the Second World War is over, rationing ends. When rationing ends, everywhere that rationing ends, the fad, the sort of energy is, let's go nuts. Eat everything. Like it becomes a very, we see consumer culture really start to escalate dramatically because you had such a period of deprivation and now all of a sudden that deprivation's gone. You can eat as many cakes as you want. No one's going to deny you the amount of flour and butter you need to make that cake, right? So go ham. That's or go cake, I guess, because I was using cake as an example.
Right.
If you go back and watch commercials, for example, for Tang, the breakfast meal replacement drink, which is what Tang was originally for, they specifically say that it has more vitamin C than a glass of orange juice. Mm. They specify that. So that is because it is a vitamin fortified drink. So have as much Tang as you want. It's got vitamins in it.
The astronauts drink it, so it's got to be good for you. You're going to grow up smart and strong and big and go to the moon.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is the mentality of the post-war period. As long as I get my vitamins, nothing else matters, right? That is that's how we're quantifying nutrition in the post-war period. That's all we are thinking of. That is on purpose. That was specifically the government's thinking. They did not consider anything else other than, do you have enough energy, calories? Like, can you get high, not hard to get your hand on high calorie food? Do you have enough vitamins and minerals? Because their targets were diseases of deficiency. By 1980, the diseases of deficiency are more or less eradicated in high income countries. Combine that with a little thing called vaccination, and infectious disease fatalities also dropped to historic lows. So by 1980, you're just unlikely to die of beriberi or whooping cough. Those things sound antiquated, and or you just live in Texas.
Womp womp.
There's a topical joke about all the whooping cough because of the anti-vaxxers in Texas, see?
What's the other thing that's going on? I'm sorry, the measles, right?
Yeah,
measles is back.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, cool, measles cool, is cool. Back.
Enough of something completely unrelated. Well, it's nice that Trump's doing the whole paracetamol thing, is it now? Or
Tylenol.
Yes, yeah. No, acetaminophen, because
and he can't say it, and he went
can't say it.
We need to do things to make these babies smarter.
Or smarter like babies. Naomi, you could be completely forgetting what he was saying and saying the dumbest thing that comes to mind, or you could have quoted him exactly.
Directly.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. He was like, these babies. We have lots of ways to make the babies smarter. And it's that encephalobetabine thing.
How do we say this?
How do we say this?
The royal we? What are we talking? Who? You're reading.
You're right, the one page. Telling us.
So by 1980, our nutrition is at an all-time high. We've done it, gang. And we haven't put a single nutrition label anywhere. They don't exist. They aren't things by 1980. Which begs a question, what the fuck happened in the 1980s? What shift could possibly have occurred that caused us to decide that we needed to put nutrition labels on when we didn't need them before? We were getting everything done. Why change the game? And that leads me to my next question, Amy. Have you ever met an Undertaker in your life?
Actually, yes, I just interviewed one for my podcast.
I may or may not have known that. But continue. Tell me about this Undertaker.
So I guess we're qualifying Undertaker as a mortician. Is that the same?
Yes. Yeah, yes, yes. Okay. But used to be called Undertakers, but yes, we would call them morticians now.
Sure. So the mortician, take care of your loved one, maybe remove them from the house where they passed away or whatever, but then make sure that they're ready for the ceremony that, you know, your religion or the preferences of the recently deceased outline.
Yes, it is a fascinating job, and one that is actually, you probably don't think about it too often. Most people don't, because you don't want to think about dying. But also, I got to tell you, a good one has a really profound impact on
absolutely
a person's life.
Absolutely.
Shout out to morticians out there.
Shout out to morticians. And the business is booming always. Yeah. It's never going to dry up. So.
Yeah, that is a recession-proof business. So let us, before we can understand what's happening in the 1980s, let's crank it back to the 1800s real quick. And let's talk about one very particular Undertaker by the name of William Banting. William Banting. So William Banting is the first person ever to invent a fad diet. Fun fact. William Banting was an undertaker. His father was the undertaker for King George II, and Banting was the undertaker for King George IV. So they were wealthy. When Banting turned 30 years old, he started to put on weight. And at his heaviest, when he was 60 years old, he weighed 202 pounds. Which is 91 kilograms or 14 and a half stone. If you live in the UK, that is, again, where largest share of our audience is from. And old people still think in stones. And he was about 5'6" or roughly 167.5 centimeters tall, which, if we look at the nonsense chart, also known as the BMI chart, that would put him just into the obese category.
I was going to say I'm
the lowest line.
BMI says I'm obese.
Yeah. Girl, BMI needs to go somewhere. Just needs to go somewhere.
I had a big meltdown about that for a while, and then someone just sat me down and was like, Naomi, you're not obese, and you need to just accept that. That's wrong. And I was like, okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Remember,
invented by men.
The BMI, not supposed to say anything about an individual person, meant to gather statistical data for a population, just so that we can understand weight to height ratios and the categories of obese and overweight and all of those things were added after the chart was invented because someone figured out they could use it for nefarious reasons. William Banting goes ballistic, and he tries to do every weight loss plan imaginable. He tries fasting, which is a terrible idea. He tries these Turkish baths where they beat him, and he tries to have the fat sort of beaten out of his body. Mm. He rows to work for 6 months and lines his boat with lead so that it's heavier, so that he has to do more of a workout.
That could be. Oh, okay. Nope. That's insane. All right.
Well, it doesn't work because every day he gets to work and he just eats so much food because he's so tired from rowing a lead boat.
Probably on an empty stomach. Good, perfect.
He does. So far, not too bad. Like, fasting is the most dangerous of these. Don't row a lead-lined boat. You can go to the gym. It's cool. The real danger shit starts happening when he starts drinking tonics, and those tonics really just cause him to have diarrhea. There's no other way around it. He's just taking laxatives. He doesn't think he's taking laxatives, but that's what happens. And of course, every time he tries one of these diets, he gets sick, he doesn't feel good, and he doesn't lose any weight. This should be a familiar story, because dieting is bullshit.
Sure is.
By the time he is 60 years old, he has trouble walking up the stairs on his own. He has to walk up them backwards. And he's unable to tie his own shoes, among a bunch of other things. All of which he ascribes to being, quote, corpulent. But in reality, it's because you've been shitting yourself for 30 years, bro. Maybe you should have just ate normal food. I think is the problem.
Anything that could have given you some joint support just flew on through.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the collagen, it probably went out of his body.
All the collagen. And this is in the late 1800s. So 60 was, you're not doing too bad if you made it to 60 in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he's born in 1798. So yes, it's right around 1860. It's right around 1860, right? Yes. Yeah, it's right around 1860. Let's just say that.
Poor guy.
I may be off go back by in time years. And
be like, hey man, it's okay. You're doing all right.
Well, wait for this. So he's tried a bunch of doctors. They're the ones who keep prescribing this stuff that just makes him sick. His friend, a doctor named William Harvey, goes to a conference in France where another doctor named Claude Bernard, who has been working with patients who have what today we call type 2 diabetes. He's been working with them, and in his dissections of people who died of diabetes, he finds that their livers excrete a sweet-tasting fluid. I don't know why he knows that this fluid is sweet-tasting, but there's only one answer to that question, and it's fucked up. It's so dark.
Let's just hope he wasn't spreading it on toast or something in the morning. I don't know.
He was squeezing dead bodies' livers and licking them. Like, that's the only thing that could happen. That's so weird. Oh, and yet.
Oh, no.
So, people who died from complications from type 2 diabetes have sugary secretions from their livers, according to this guy. So, he starts treating his living patients by introducing a low sugar and starch diet. Which, by the way, gang, if you've got type 2 diabetes, is still what your doctor does. They treat you by saying you need to not be consuming a shitload of sugar. That is true. He also remarks in his sort of lecture he's giving that most of his patients experienced weight loss during their diet. So Harvey goes back to his buddy Banting and says, I got an idea. Cut out sugar and starches from your diet. And he says to Banting, all right, what are you eating in a day that has sugar or starches in it? And Banting goes, oh, well, I put a little sugar in my tea. Harvey goes, cool, how much sugar you put in your tea? And he goes, per cup, about 2 tablespoons.
Holy, wow.
Allegedly 2 tablespoons. When I first read it, I thought, this clearly, because this is from the 1860s, we've had some sort of, it's teaspoons. It should be teaspoons. But no, it was indeed 2 tablespoons.
That's like 30 grams of sugar per tea.
Easily.
That's like most of what you should probably eat in a day for the average person. Like, I don't know, because I don't keep track of that. I also go through his diet. He has 2 pints of beer at meals, both lunch and dinner, every day. And he eats a pastry and potatoes every day at lunch and dinner. So these are all the things that Harvey is like, oh yeah, stop doing that. Don't do that anymore. That's his recommendation. So obviously, Amy, a year later, how's Banting doing?
If did I don't know, because like me personally, I've been like, no, I'm not gonna do any of that. That sounds terrible. But did he stick to it? Did he lose weight?
Yeah, no, he did. He sticks to the diet every day. He keeps a journal every day. He marks all of the progress.
All right.
And like, yeah, he went from drinking four pints of beer a day and having minimum 4 tablespoons of sugar in his tea down to 1 glass of Claret a day. Yeah, he's doing better a year later. It turns out maybe you shouldn't drink a metric shit ton of alcohol and just pure crack cocaine sugar. He loses 30 pounds over the year.
Oh, the pub is fun. I co-sign this. That's super lame.
He loses 30 pounds and he's like, I'm doing amazing. This is the best I've ever felt in my entire life. Yeah, of course. So in 1863, he writes a book. The book is titled A Letter on Corpulence Addressed to the Public. This is like, I love whenever we get book titles from the 19th century because they're always like stupidly descriptive. Like we had the one that was like an address on like the founding of Massachusetts by Eric the Red in the year. Like it's this huge long thing. It's just the title of the book.
Corpulence. We need to bring that word back. What a great word. Corpulence.
Corpulence, for the people who don't know, fat. He's just fat. It's a letter on being fat. That's it. He goes through his whole story. He does what every like nutrition influencer that you know on the internet does. Like I couldn't tie my own shoes. And then I did this one simple trick and I can run a marathon and punch Superman in the face.
I am healed.
You'll feel it. Yeah. And other people buy the book. It gets 3 editions. It sells so quickly within its first, I believe, 2 years. And lots of people love it. It is the first fad diet. 1863 is when fad diets were invented. Nobody understood why, by the way, this was working. Like, not eating as much sugar and starches. The best explanation at the time was that sugars and starches were combustible and that therefore, when we breathe oxygen in, it must cause those sugars to combust inside of the body, and that makes us fat. I love the 19th century. Please go ahead, Amy.
Wait, so I was going to ask something else, but is that where burning calories comes from then? The phrase burning calories?
No, that is not where the phrase burning calories comes from. We test what a calorie is using a bomb calorimeter, which basically ignites the material that you want to test. And then a bunch of data comes back and you find out how many liters of water it would raise, how many degrees Celsius, and then that is the number of calories in that thing.
I liked Amy's description more. That's what I'm going to tell people.
You said combustible, so I just was like, oh, okay, you know, explosions.
So they didn't know what the hell was going on. They were just like, I don't know, apparently it makes you less fat, and fat people are something we don't like because we're the Victorian Britain, and we invent the idea that being fat is bad. By 1910, though, we discover vitamins. And once vitamins become a thing, we see those take over. And excess adiposity, which is the fancy way of saying fat, it's still a thing, but it recedes substantially as popular fad diets. And of course, this is when the government is ramping up its efforts to give us what the minimum nutritional threshold is. I just want to, this is where fad diets come from. Then we have this lovely period of time from, you know, the 1920s, but really ramping up in 41, all the way to 1980, where nutrition and health are all about getting enough food. And now we can return to 1980 when things change. As we quantify nutrition, and we say meeting a minimum health threshold means you won't get diseases, people start thinking, oh, food is medicine. These two things are associated with one another. Which is why in 1959, a life insurance company published a pamphlet called Build and Blood Pressure, which basically said that if you have high blood pressure or you are fat, they were going to charge you more money for life insurance because there were associations between those two things and chronic diseases that end in fatalities, notably heart disease. Spot on about the blood pressure, by the way. The build, less so. It's not based on any scientific evidence. It's just based on their customer base and self-reported data.
So build, are we talking about anatomy build?
Yeah, I don't know like fat.
Okay.
Whether or not your body looks fat. Like they say build because it's 1959. They're trying to be polite.
Sure.
Could have been called a letter on corpulence, but it's 1959.
Got it.
And this pamphlet takes off. People really start panicking about this connection between food, which makes you fat. If you eat too much, you get fat, and disease. Around the same time, Dwight D. Eisenhower, president of the United States, had a heart attack. Had a heart attack in 1955. And a couple years later, his doctor published papers about his experience treating President Eisenhower and his recommendation, because Eisenhower by 1959 is fit as a fiddle, you know, he recovers from his heart attack quite well. His papers focus on the fact that he changed the president's diet to reduce saturated fats and that it was his meat-eaten diet that caused him to have a heart attack. Now, did Dwight Eisenhower smoke a pipe every day of his life? Of course he fucking did. Of course he did. Oh, but the tobacco industry won't let you put that in your little doctor's report, will they?
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. No, sir.
Certainly not.
So people are freaking out. They're like, oh my God, eating food could kill me or at least make me sick, right? What do I do? No one has a good solution to this. And then in the late 1960s, Dr. Robert Atkins reads a letter on corpulence because he is working with diabetic patients, and a letter on corpulence appears in literature reviews because, of course, as we said, it was the connection between diabetes and weight loss as a treatment for diabetes that led Banting in the first place to go on his diet. So Atkins reads a letter on corpulence and says, huh, it seems like this guy really cracked back in 1863 how to treat disease, chronic diseases like diabetes, by controlling his weight. Banting did not have diabetes. He never had diabetes. He was not being treated for diabetes. He had no known chronic illnesses. I do believe he died of a heart attack when he was in his 80s.
Wow.
Yeah. The guy lived normally, except for that whole weird period where he was shitting himself every day.
And walking upstairs backwards.
And walking upstairs backwards. Like, I don't, like, Atkins.
I know. I got a little angry. As soon as you said the name Atkins, my eye roll. You may have heard that through the microphone.
So, yes, he reads Banting's book. He goes, huh, if we can control weight, we can control diabetes. So, Dr. Atkins, instead of testing his theory that weight loss will stop disease, he just writes a book called The Diet Revolution in 1972, which says that excess adiposity or corpulence, as Banting would have put it, was a clear sign of ill health and was directly caused by excess consumption of sugars and carbohydrates. The difference between Atkins and Banting, though, is Banting's running on vibes, right? He's saying, don't drink beer, don't put sugar in your tea, eat some vegetables, eat some meats. Atkins, though, is 100 years in the future where we have started quantifying things, right? Mm. We know that there are numbers you need to hit to reach minimum nutrition. So clearly there must be numbers you must not hit for maximum nutrition, which is to say over nutrition. And so in his book, he starts talking specifically about grams of carbohydrates consumed in a day. And his idea is to get as close to zero as humanly possible.
Oh my God. I can't.
Yes. So it is our man, Dr. Atkins, who kicks off the idea that you must eat as few carbohydrates as possible, and your fat and protein consumption are largely irrelevant. So fry up some bacon. Just don't put it on toast.
I remember this.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I remember the whole bacon versus apple argument.
Mm-hmm. People loved it.
You can have a pound of bacon, but you can't have an apple. Yep.
You could have it in everything that is in a ham sandwich, except for the bread and the tomato. Like if you put tomato on your ham sandwich, which is
my artery slammed shut just listening to that right now.
So this is the beginning. 1972 is the beginning of the shifting the target for nutrition from preventing disease by meeting minimum nutrition standards and shifting it to preventing chronic disease by preventing the overconsumption of macromolecules. Banting's pamphlet is actually republished after the diet revolution comes out, like, because he cites it, he references it in the book, and it becomes a bestseller. Bestseller in like 1980, I think it was, or 1979. It is cited, actually, a letter on corpulence is cited in the congressional hearings that inform the creation of nutrition labels, by the way. When congressman's holds up his letter on corpulence and says, we've known about this since 1863. It all came from an undertaker. So we have just this undertaker invents the idea of the fad diet. Science comes in and starts to actually quantify how food and nutrition works. And when those two forces collide, when the science work did good and made disease go away, and all that was left was diseases that the science couldn't deal with yet, possibly ever, I don't know. It's a fun thing about science. We don't know a lot of things, and you have to accept that. In stepped the fad diets, and then the fad diets start to inform this scientifically minded approach. I loved having you on this episode, Amy, specifically because this is kind of the problem in science communication. This is why we need science communicators. The nutrition label wanted to quantify nutrition to treat chronic disease, but we don't know how to do that. That's not a thing that we understand. And so what ends up happening is the nutrition label, instead of actually being guidance for how to treat chronic disease for individuals, became just data that marketers can use to sell diets. That is what happened. That is how it all came together.
My reoccurring thought through all of this was, oh, how do we treat like chronic disease? Where is it coming from? And like the C word, aka capitalism, wasn't mentioned once from like the 80s. You know what you just said, science being then weaponized into marketing, and then from the 80s on, this whole, you know, we could do a whole series on unpacking this. You know, the importance of skinniness to success, and you know, the need to look a certain way to be considered smart or taken seriously by the public or the media or whatever, and just like, you know, maybe people are keeling over from heart attacks because they have to work 40 to 80 hours a week and they're not being paid enough and they don't have life insurance because life insurance said they won't cover them because they're fat or whatever. Like,
yeah,
there's so many things besides just what's on that nutrition label in the cereal box and, you know, what we hear on congressional hearings.
It is such a complicated story that is totally wrapped up in capitalism. And the only reason I did not pepper capitalism through this whole episode is we just don't have time. We're running long already.
As like it is.
It, yeah. Because yes, of course, the whole other part of it is the nutrition labels put the burden on the individual to take action mm-hmm. as opposed to government.
Make
in
good
this
choices
case. And, yeah, yeah, you're making healthy choices. Exactly. Individuals are charged with making those healthy choices based on the science, the data, right? Here's your nutrition label, regardless of the fact that absolutely no one is equipped to do it. Not like even the most even mm-hmm, nutritionists mm-hmm. are barely qualified to make those choices. Like they have to factor in so much more than what's on the back of a goddamn nutrition label in the aisle of Walmart.
One thing you could attribute and tie up in a nice little bow would be, this is a perfect demonstration of how the information deficit model does not work. So that says that, oh, well, the more information we give people, the more likely they are to make better choices, the more likely they are to vote mm-hmm. the way we want them to vote, or to be pro GMO or whatever, you know. And it's just especially in this case, it's just not the case. You know, we can provide all the stats, we can provide all the nutrition labels, we can provide all the food pyramids and whatnot, but it doesn't mean folks are ultimately going to choose better or, you know, believe things like podcasters, you know, who are health influencers that may or may not be in charge of our entire health system here in the States right now, who are running off of vibes, like you said. So it's rough. It's rough out there. I would say the one thing does work for everyone, and that's being nicer to yourself. I think one of my favorite phrases, no one has ever hated themselves into a better version of themselves. So there you go. That's my soapbox moment.
Excellent. Well, Amy, was there anything new you learned today that you did not know going in?
So much. Yeah, I wasn't sure where we were going on this journey. I think the nutrition label history is definitely one that in general was new. And I want to say vitamins, the origin of the term vitamin, that was super interesting to me. Because I think being a science person, you kind of, and a history person as well, like you kind of know to look at the root words of things. But that's one that's so used every day that I just never considered. Where did that come from? That was really interesting. And I think it also is not a surprise to me how long we've been hating on fat people. But, you know, hearing some specific dates and history events makes me like, oh, dang it. Like, no wonder, you know, we're climbing uphill here, like working against a long time. And just interesting to hear like the way a lot of, even if it's not an overt, like the BMI chart, even if it's just like general feelings folks have that I've encountered and I've seen over the years, like, oh, this is rooted in a long time ago. We've been dealing with this for a long time. Interesting. Oh, yeah. So.
Yeah. So gang, I hope you now are empowered to just be nice to yourself. You can look at the nutrition label if you want, but remember, it's kind of there to push the onus on you to not overeat, which is, by the way, why the color-coded thing really doesn't work, Britain, because you know what? Nobody cares if it's red. Nobody cares. Doesn't stop you from eating it because it's fucking delicious, okay? And no one's going to pay attention to that. It's not like putting lungs on a cigarette packet. You know, it's just, it's not going to work that well. If you want to continue to love yourself, the best thing you can do is subscribe to the podcast. You're listening to it or watching it somewhere right now. If you hit subscribe, you'll feel good. You will lose weight and feel better. No, I can't say that. You will feel good, though, because you subscribe to a show which seeks to understand the weird, the everyday, the unexpected, and perhaps the healing that is in our history. Also, could you leave us a comment somewhere? We've been getting more comments recently, and I would like to have more of them because they're great. We would love to hear about your deep dive stories. You all out there are smart people and you get weirdly knowledgeable about something. Share it with us. Leave it in a comment and we might feature it in our monthly newsletter, which you can do all that at seeminglyunrelatedpod.com. You can get the links to everything where you can leave comments. And Amy, where can folks find you?
Well, like I said before, I've myself dipped my toe into the podcasting waters, and I have a show called Blue Collar, White Coat, where we kind of, on the same idea, talk to folks that you might not normally think of as being in a STEM field, like my mortician friend, right? But also folks that, instead of wearing a white coat to work, if they're in STEM, might wear hard hats, might wear steel toe boots. They might be on the side of a mountain handling a wildland fire, or could be your dental hygienist, right? Somebody that you interact with every day, folks that are doing the science and maybe have that white coat, but came up in a very, I don't know, maybe like a single family, a single parent family. Maybe they dropped out of school for a while and came back, you know, untraditional routes. So that is the kind of person. Those are the stories that we're telling on Blue Collar, White Coat. And you can find us there anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, of course, and on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. You can find us with at Blue Collar, White Coat Pod. And you can shoot me an email there, too, if you have an idea for an episode or you want to know more about what we do. It's the same thing, bluecollarwhitecoatpod@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Amy. I think this went very well. And we will be back in 2 weeks for the season 2 finale of Seemingly Unrelated. What will it be about? I know. And only I know. Not even Naomi knows yet, because I haven't finished the script. So until then, gang, so long. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone. Audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Coe. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seemingly unrelatedpod.com.